You know, they tell a story about a fellow who's on a public bus, and as he's going from stop to stop, he looks out the window and he sees that there's a very odd incident unfolding in front of his eyes. He sees that there are two gentlemen who are busy doing the most absurd thing. One of them is busy digging a ditch, and the other one right next to him is busy filling that same ditch in. And he is so perplexed by this activity that he immediately gets off at the next stop, even though it isn't his stop, and he walks back to them. These are city employees, and, you know, wondering where his good tax money is actually going. He says, you know, I couldn't help but notice, but you're digging a ditch and filling in the same ditch. What in the world are you doing? So then they say, they explain very politely that, in fact, they're usually a landscaping team of three. You see, John digs the ditches, Fred is the one who puts the trees in, and Joe is the one who covers it. But today, Fred was sick. And so I decided to carry on working in anyway. And so sometimes in our lives, we have those moments where we sometimes do what we do because we've been doing it, and we carry on doing it because we were doing it, and we end up just covering up the dirt that somebody else was digging. Or we carry on digging a ditch which somebody else is filling because we forgot there's a tree that's meant to go in the middle. And so it really behooves us, especially at this time of the year, to work out why we're doing what we are actually doing. Or otherwise, we just carry on digging ditches. So let's try to utilize our 9 days, not to try to distract ourselves from not being able to swim and drink and eat meat and all the different restrictions that we experience. Let's try under those restrictions, let's try within this period of scrutiny, try to understand what we're doing, where we're coming from, where we are going. So I'd like to explore with you a new idea. This is, I've many shirim on this particular space and time, and I didn't want to go into old territory. This is completely new. This is the first time that I'm trying to address this particular topic. I'd like to unfold it with you together this morning. It's the most remarkable idea, and sometimes I know that there's different styles of shirim. Sometimes there's shirim which are very masterful, and they're beautiful shirim with lots of flowery stories and calls to action. That's a very important dimension of shirim, and we should not underestimate the role of emotions. But let's remember that the bedrock of our Torah relies on our intellect and understanding why we're doing what we're doing. So this morning I'm pivoting away from the model of the emotions into the model of the mind. Let's open up our minds and try to really, really understand this very important idea, because it is really, truly remarkable, at least from my perspective, what I've had the opportunity of learning. Let's learn this together. Just as a side, I'm going to interrupt myself for a second. It's so beautiful to hear all the Tehillim that people say together. If anybody is interested, I do a daily Tehillim podcast. I see a number of people that are learning. We're in the middle of Tehillim right now. We're up to Mem Ches this morning, actually. And it's a 10-minute podcast of just an overview of what the Tehillim means, rather than saying what we're saying just because of that. Everybody's welcome to join if you'd like the details afterwards. But let's delve straight in over here. The Mishnah in Ta'anis tells us, at the very end in Perek Dalad Mishnah, Vav tells us, Chamisha Devarim Eru Avoseinu B'Shiva Saba Tammuz. There were 5 things that occurred on the fast, what we today fast on the 17th of Tammuz, and 5 things happened on Tishvav. Sounds like a little bit of a round number there. One would have to wonder if those are the only 5 that occurred on both. Nonetheless, the Mishnah tells us, what are those 5 things? And it gives us a list which doesn't really seem to necessarily give us one motif, one theme. So when it comes to Shiva Saba Tammuz, it tells us, Nishtabru Aluchos. We know that the Egel HaZahav occurred on Yud Zayin B'Tammuz. That's logical, because when was the Torah given? Just let's date ourselves quickly. Torah was given on what day? It was a Shavuos. When was Shavuos? Vav Sivan. Actually, that was Zayin Sivan, some machlokes in the Gemara, but let's assume Zayin Sivan, which is what the Gemara seems to end up with. 40 days later, Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from Har Sinai. What's 40 days later from Zayin Sivan? It's Yud Zayin B'Tammuz, naturally, right? So that was when Moshe Rabbeinu came down. That was when the Egel HaZahav happened, and of course the Luchos were broken. That's reason number one. Reason number two, Batel HaTamid. The Tamid was stopped. What is the Tamid exactly? Tamid means? Right, so it's a twice a day consistent korban. The word Tamid means consistent. So that consistent korban was stopped when the city was under siege. They were no longer had access to the animals necessary to be able to produce the korban Tamid. So that's reason number two. Hufka Ha'ir, the city was breached, meaning Jerusalem under siege, was breached. Actually, there were two sieges, the first Beis HaMikdash and the second Beis HaMikdash. And the date that we follow is actually the second Beis HaMikdash breaching. The date of the first breaching was actually the 9th of Tammuz. So this is but it's the same. It's the same time we follow the second destruction, which was more severe. Number three. Now I'm going into number four. Vesorof Apus Tomos Es HaTorah, a Roman governor burned the Torah. Vehem Yitzelam HaHeichal, and he or it or somebody put a tzelem, a image in the Heichal, in the temple. That's the list of five for Shiva Sabbatamos. We're familiar with this. We've heard these reasons for many, many years. Then on the other side, B'tisha B'av, the Mishnah tells us, there's also five things. Nigzar alav asen shelo yikon su la'aretz. We were decreed upon for not entering the land. Why did that happen? Miraglim, fantastic. That happened on Tisha B'av itself. And Chorav HaBayis Borishana of Ashnia, we know that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed time one and time two, both specifically on Tisha B'av. Nilkado Beitar. Beitar was conquered. Where's Beitar? So it was a city in the Yehudim Shomron area. Maybe we'll get back to some of the details. It was the last bastion. This was after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. This was the last bastion of the Bar Kokhba rebellion in the year 135. Common era, that's already 60 years plus after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And finally, Nechrasha Ha'ir, the city was plowed, and that actually happened later on. Okay, these are the five things, and therefore, this is the reason why we fast in these days. There's just a few basic questions. Are these causes? Are these causes for the fast day? It's interesting because, on the one hand, they were actually fasting on these days during earlier times than some of these events occurred. Which means to say that it's hard to say that these events were necessarily causes of, but perhaps, maybe even, these were the results of the day. It means like, where does it start from? What's the starting point? Is this the reason? Or is this an indicator, what is called a siman or siba? Is this a sign? Or is this a reason for the fast day? That's number one. But number two, five sounds a little bit too clean, don't you think? Meaning to say, I'm sure we could find numerous other events, and in fact there are. If you go through history and just look at a cursory glance, there are numerous dates which certainly populate these days. So as for example, Tisha B'Av. I mean, Tisha B'Av was a day which throughout is barely a century we can't find a Tisha B'Av with something on it. The expulsion from the Jews of Spain was on Tisha B'Av. The expulsion of the Jews from England 200 years earlier than that was also on Tisha B'Av. And this wasn't because they were planning this. This is just how it worked out. The signing of the final solution, 1942, was on Tisha B'Av. We should just realize that there's a lot of very serious day things that happen on Tisha B'Av. Now, of course, the Mishnah is not going forward in history. It's going backwards. But I'm sure we could find more, right? We could find more items to put onto that list. So why five? That's a question. Why does it work out that there's five on each side? Five for Shiva Sabbatamos, five for Tisha B'Av as a starting point. But more than that, There seems to be almost a sort of a parallelism over here between the beginning and the ending of this period. Five at the beginning, five at the end. What's going on over here? Are these incidents the most consequential in Jewish history? The fact that Apus Thomas burnt the Torah, that was a seismic change in Jewish history that was so important and so significant that's why we can think of pretty atrocious events that occurred in Jewish history. Why specifically these events? So the basic question is what's the mission talking about over here? Why is it that these events frame our state of existence even today? That's the starting point. So what we're going to do is we're going to actually really just put that question on hold. Let's refocus on that in a few minutes' time. We're going to go back to the very, very beginning of creation. And this is an idea which is so powerful. It is so transformational that, you know, I don't see my life the same way again after I learned this. And I hope that we all have the opportunity of imbibing it and letting it in as well. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to actually explore the ideas of an individual whose name was Rav Moshe Shapiro, of blessed memory. He was a Rav in Yerushalayim. Just a picture just for those who are able to see. Rav Moshe Shapiro was a transformational leader in many, many ways. And he was the Rav of many. He was one of the greatest Ba'alei Machshava, one of the greatest thinkers in Jewish thought, creative thinkers in Jewish thought in the last century, really passed away very recently in the last few years. And after his death, actually, a lot of his students have been putting out a lot of his teachings in beautiful volumes. There's a number of volumes called Shuvi V'Nechaze, which has been translated into English and is initially in Hebrew. Really, really beautiful insights. I'd like to share some of his teachings this morning, just to give you a sense of the people. You know, like when we hear Rabbi Dr. Akiva Tatz, Rabbi Tatz spent all his time with Rav Moshe Shapiro. That was where he nursed his learning from, was Rav Moshe Shapiro in Yerushalayim, his Thursday night shirim. For those who know Rav Moshe Hauer in Baltimore, also spent an incredible amount of time. These are individuals that were influenced, and many, many, many more. Let's start at the very beginning. So the Gemara tells us in Menachos a very interesting fact. And that is, let's start at the very, very beginning. Genesis, Bereishis, Perek, Beis. The Torah tells us an interesting thing, and that is that it describes how the world was created. This is very significant, because if we can understand the genes of the world, we can understand everything that comes afterwards. The Gemara tells us, quoting the Pasuk, Eile told us Hashemayim v'ha'aretz v'hibaram. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created. Now you'll notice something interesting. If you open up a Chumash, you will see the word v'hibaram is spelt with an idiosyncrasy. And that is, v'hibaram literally translates as when it was created. But what's different about that word? What's strange about it? There's a small hey, fantastic. Thank you. It's a pleasure dealing with a chevra who is so involved. Behibaram, it is spelled with a small hey. It's one of the first uniquenesses in terms of the script. Behibaram. The Gemara tells us that the reason why it's spelled like that is almost as a sort of flag to make us notice this and realize that something is going on over here. And the Gemara comments and says, Al tekre behibaram. Don't read it as when it was created, when it was created. Rather, read it as behei bera'am. The world was created, so to speak, with the letter hey. With the letter hey. Meaning, it's punctuated as such to indicate that this world was created with the letter hey. The Gemara actually points out that the world to come was created with the letter yud, and the letter of this world is the letter hey. Of course, the name of Hashem, those basic framework of the name of Hashem is Yud and then a Hey together, which is the combination of what we'll call Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. Fantastic. So what does that mean? Okay, so now we're there. This world is a Hey world. What exactly does that mean? The Gemara actually gives a fascinating, somewhat well-known insight. The Gemara says it's because the shape itself lends itself to understanding what this world is all about. So as we all see, when you look at the letter Hey, for an example, so you have, of course, you have the roof, you have the side, and then you have a little leg. And there's a gap between the leg and the roof on the left-hand side, unlike the letter Ches, as an example. So Gemara says an interesting insight. Hard to understand. There's something about the notion of return, which is expressed in this world. The Gemara says, why? Mimnei shedomeh la'achsadra. This world is like a passageway. Shekol arotze lotzeis yetzei. That anybody who wants to escape it can leave. Meaning to say, our movement is always, which direction?
Upwards,
right? So this world is meant to be an upwards moving, an upwards movement, as you're supposed to get towards to the top. And the Gemara says, and why is it talya di'yohadar b'tshuva ma'aliyelei? And the Gemara says, why is it that the leg is hanging, so that if a person wants to do tshuva, they can re-enter, re-access the world, even though they may have fallen out. The Gemara actually goes on to explain that there's a certain almost inertia, is a gravity that people can fall out the bottom but can really crawl their way back in. Which is the notion of this world. We are created as human beings. Human beings are imperfect. As I say, some people are more human than others. But really, we all struggle. We're all dealing with inertia. We're all climbing. We're all trying to get back in or trying to get out, whichever way it is. And that's the notion of this world. There's never a moment of cruise control. You know, there was a fellow who once sued an RV company because it was the days when cruise control had just came out, and he puts the RV on cruise control and went to make a coffee at the back. It was the days before Tesla was experimenting with highway driving, right? So it doesn't work like that in life. There's no time in life to make a coffee in the back. That's not how it works. We're always climbing. Just as we think we've reached a plateau, we find new challenges. And not that we find them, they find us. There's never a moment, and that tension is actually part of the existence of life. Some of them they feel unbearable, some of them surmountable, but they're always different. And that's really the human condition, which the Gemara is explaining to us is in the letter Hey. That's a very beautiful understanding. However, there's another dimension of it, and this is what Rav Moshe Shapiro says, and this is something I had never heard before. something which is truly a remarkable perspective. Let's look at the letter of hey, the letter hey, a little differently. Let's look at it as shapes rather than perhaps the way we used to see it. So we look at it from this perspective. Really, the letter hey, if you think about it, is two lines, a vertical and a horizontal line and a dot. If you think about that, halachically speaking, the hey, the actual leg, technically is a yud. A yud can be expressed on its most basic level as a dot. Of course, that's without hidur, without its best expression, but a dot and two lines. So if you think about it from that perspective, what that means to say is that apparently everything in this world has that basic DNA. You know, if you were to go down and you were to look under a microscope at everything in the world, you'd be able to see, we'll call it the spiritual DNA, is two lines and a dot. Now, we haven't discovered that under the microscope, but that's because we're using the wrong instrumentation. So what does it mean that if you were to look at everything, there is really a two lines and a dot? What does that exactly mean? So Rav Moshe Shapiro says, this is a remarkable insight. And that is, everything in this world has a point of origin. That point of origin is beyond its expression. It really exists in, we'll call it, a space of potential alone. It's beyond expression. It has not been unfolded, unpacked yet. Every existent in this world has a point of origin. Then from that point of origin, there's movement. And that movement is, if you think about it, on the two-dimensional plane, which is the only space a letter can occupy, on a two-dimensional plane, there is an expansion in both directions. And that essentially creates the two planes of the two-dimensional existence. We'll call the x-axis and the y-axis of existence. And every point that this dot expands to can be plotted on the x or y-axis. You can plot it somewhere. It has two sets of coordinates, and those are the two lines. Think about this for a second. So we have point of origin and expansion in both directions, which is occurring with the letter hey. And therefore, that means to say that everything in this world is subject to that same framework. Everything in this world has its point of origin, its potential, and then its expression as it turns that potential, if it chooses to, into its actual. But it's more than that. This isn't just ideas. This isn't simply just philosophizing. This is much more than that. Let's take it to the next step. This is deeply rooted in Jewish thought itself, because the Mishnah in Perkei Avos tells us, the beginning of the third perek, Akavya ben Mahalalel Oimer, Akavya ben Mahalalel would say, Histakel b'shloisha dvorin v'i'ato bolidei avera. If there's three things that we meditate upon, we'll never arrive at an avera. What are those three things? He says, the first two are the ones that are important to us. Da me'ayin basa ula'an ato holech. Know where you came from and know where you're going. Now, he means it in a very basic way. Meaning to understand the humility of the human condition, understand the biological material that we're made of, and understand where we're going to be ending up. That's the most basic understanding. But really, that's a question that we could ask anybody. We could ask ourselves all the time in life. Is, where did we come from? Where are we going? That's the real question that every person has. Where Rav Shapiro argues is that's the first line. The first line is the lateral line. It's going from a point and it's moving to a point. If you think about it, the first point is that you take this point of expansion, this potential, and our lifetime is a trajectory moving from where me'ayin basa to la'ana taholech. We're moving from where we started off and we're ending up where we should be. There are a lot of people in life who end up just really sort of cruising along and not really traveling, if you think about it. They go with the flow of the current of life, and they end up really the same kind of person that they started off being. Babies enter this world as very selfish, very self-centered beings. All not because they're choosing to be, but because by necessity, a child's needy. So what do? They spend all their time grabbing towards themselves. They need food, they need support, they need comfort, they need help. And if a person doesn't develop themselves in life, they end up being the same kind of person, just in a more sophisticated fashion. So when it comes to nap time, as adults would call it, lack of coffee time, right, they react in a similar, more sophisticated fashion, but they haven't yet developed themselves in a way where they've actually worked on themselves to say that they're not going to be pulling towards themselves or getting irritated at other people during that space. So there's a movement of a person that the person is supposed to develop from a place and arrive at another place at the end of the journey. That's what we'll call the lateral line number one. So there's a point of potential. Now we're moving from something to something. And then there's another dimension, and that's what we'll call left and right, the other line, right? So there's the line of origin, there's a line of, we'll call it origin to destination, and there's a line of right and left. What does right and left mean in Jewish thought? It's a very interesting idea. There's a lot of very interesting ideas here, Kabbalistically speaking, but not to get into the Kabbalistic sides, just on the most basic level. The Gemara tells us in Sota, a very important line. The Gemara tells us, it says, La'olam, always. This is a rule. In other words, when you say the Gemara is saying La'olam, that means this is default. Yitaheh samol doiche v'yamin makareves. The small, the left, is pushing aside, and the right is pulling towards. By the way, this is a very important psychological insight. I remember hearing, when we used to live in Chicago, once Dr. Pelkovitz came out to speak, he said a really interesting thing, and he speaks about this a lot, and he talks about how we're a generation, whether it be parenting, whether it be educators, of yamin makarev. We're a generation of a lot of pulling towards, a lot of enriching experiences. But there's not enough simol doicha. There's not enough the left hand pushing aside. He gave an example. He said that he got a call, and anybody who's ever called Dr. Pelkovitz knows that his cell phone says, "I'm sorry, I'm not accepting new clients." And he's very involved in many world issues. And he kept on getting this call again and again and again. And it was a call from an educator on the West Coast who said, "I'm not going to let you off this phone until you give me a date to speak. I have a school here. You need to come and speak at the school." Why? So the lady said, "Because we had an incident where there was a first grader who had a party at a disco club, some sort of a teenage disco club. And when the other parents were horrified at this, they asked, why did you do this?" The parents said, "Because the child asked." Now, it may seem funny, but because the child asked is not the reason we do things. There's yamin makarev, but there's a small doche. There's limits. We set restrictions. What children want isn't what children get. And if parents don't have that knowledge, she said, I can't responsibly let the children back in school until you've come to talk about education. So this is a very important rule in general in life. But what Rav Shapiro does is he takes it to the next level. Here's how he does it. Yamin Mekarev means to say that when we're on our journey in life, we're moving from our origin to our destination, we're moving along that line, there is movement in either direction, to the right and the left. And how does that work? That means to say that there's sometimes in life, our point of existence is to proactively do things, to achieve things in this world. We were uniquely, each one of us were gifted with a specific assets, whether it be our character, our psychology, our surroundings. We have ability to be able to change the world, to shape it in a particular way. That's challenge number one in our lives. Challenge number two is small doche, and that's what's called sur merah, don't do bad, right? Don't do negativity. And it's interesting, it's fascinating to focus on this. You'll find some people who spend their entire lives working on the yamin makarev, changing the world, right? But they haven't yet worked out that dark corner of the soul, right? Whether it be anger, impatience, whatever it is that they need to be working on, they're saving the world, they're doing a tremendous job, but they haven't yet done the small doche, which is the internal work of fixing that little space which may have been the part of the reason why that person was here. And you have other people spend their entire life working on themselves, but they haven't yet actualized proactivity in the world around them. It requires a little bit of both. We need to, in a certain sense, avoid negativity. We need to be able to protect ourselves and work on why we're here internally. We also need to be using our assets and our kochos to change the world. You know, I just heard recently Rav Avigdor Miller told a story about a fellow who got a job as a trucker. And so his job was to, bring goods across the country. So in his first cross-country journey, he arrives in California, he arrives in the depot, he comes to the dispatcher, and he very proudly puts the keys on the table and said, "No tickets." So the man says, that's fantastic, where are the goods? He says, "I didn't bring the goods, I just got no tickets." So the man says, "I'm sorry. If you're to bring the goods and you got a ticket, okay, we could talk about that. But if you didn't deliver the goods, there's no point in getting no tickets." Right, you have to have the balance of no tickets, the small doche, and also you have to have the min makarev, you need to be delivering the goods. There's two dimensions in that. So therefore, says Rav Moshe Shapiro, if you think about this, every single entity in this world has the same question. What is your point of potential? Where are you coming from, where you're going? What are you doing actively, and what are you doing defensively? That is really what the person, well, not a person, but every object and every human, every animal's existence in this world has the same dimensions. A point of origin, we'll call it the point of potential, origin, destination, proactivity, and defensiveness, as to be able to arrive at the end of the end with our fully packaged deal. That's really what life is all about. So that's what it means to say, Behi Barom, that the world is created with a hey. Of course, that makes a lot of sense, because what is the gematria of the letter hey? What is the numerical value? Is, of course, five, because in the dimension that we're talking about, there are five points. there's potential, there's origin, destination, right and left. So those are the 5 points, which obviously reflect the inner reality of the actual shape itself. Okay, good. So now, what is in the world does this have to do with now? That if this first of all, let's for a moment just digest that. That's a very important point. So that forgetting the 3 weeks for a second, that itself is just a very important point about trying to understand life and understanding where along that trajectory we are, frontwards, backwards. Where are we on that trajectory, rightwards, leftwards? Is what we're unpacking really our potential or somebody else's potential? Are we living up to somebody else's dot or our dot? These are important questions we should be asking ourselves independently of anything to do with the 3 weeks. But now when it comes to the 3 weeks, let's understand this. Of course, this relates to that mission in Tainus because five. There are 5 points of destruction described in Sheva Asava Tammuz, and there are 5 points of destruction described in Tisha B'Av. What Rav Moshe Shapiro argues is... 1 second. Timing, Rebbetzin. Okay, so we're going to try to get this into 50. We'll see how much we can get, okay? So let's try the best we can. So what he argues is a very interesting thing. He says that if you look at Shiva Asava Tammuz, essentially, when you talk about absolute destruction, we're talking about absolute destruction on all five levels. In terms of potential, in terms of origin, destination, right and left. That's the way it should map out, naturally, right? If the mission is talking about these 5 points. Let's try to do that together. So when it comes back to the Shiva Asava Tammuz for a second, so obviously that nakuda, that point of potential, the destruction, or the common denominator on the destruction of Shiva Asava Tammuz, which we just experienced 2 weeks and 2 days ago, is the experience of the destruction, the whole destruction essentially of Torah, giving. How do you know? Because what's the potential point which was destroyed? The original point was the destruction of the Luchos. The Luchos, if you think about it, those tablets which Moshe Rabbeinu got when he was coming down from Har Sinai, essentially included everything. They included everything that was supposed to be in the sum total of Torah was to be incorporated into those Luchos. So when those were broken, in a certain sense, that was all potential. That was everything. And by the way, it wasn't as if we got the second package good as new. There were differences. When Moshe Rabbeinu was involved in chiseling out those Luchos al Pi Hashem, it wasn't the same. There were certain things psychologically which changed in the human psyche in terms of memory, in terms of the way of learning, which were incorporated in the second Luchos. So there was a significant change which occurred. That we'll call is our potential. Now, how does that express itself in reality, in terms of destination and origin? So what Rav Moshe Shapiro points out is that if you think about it, when did the Korban Tamid actually ever begin? When did that daily sacrifice begin? And the answer is right after the giving of the Torah. If you read, even before the Mishkan, if you read the end of Parshas Mishpatim, there was a deal made that what's called the Bris Sinai was made between Israel and HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the sacrifice of this ox. At that point in time, argues Rav Moshe Shapiro, was the beginning of a consistent connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that consistent connection is not simply just, oh, it's good for us to be serving God, which, you know, Hashem needs our karbonos. What it means to say is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is educating us by rote to say that on a daily basis, this matters. That means to say, it's not like you come into shul and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and that's how you pay homage to God, and the rest of the time, you'll have a dandy existence. No, on a day-to-day basis, morning and evening. In fact, there is a famous midrash which is actually only quoted in the introduction of the Ein Yaakov. It's not extant elsewhere. But the midrash is quoted that there was a dispute as to what's the most important pasuk in the Torah. One was Shema Yisrael. The one suggestion is sacrifice the one lamb in the morning, the one lamb in the afternoon. It's consistency. There are many people with big ideas. There are many people who sign up for their gym membership, and 3 weeks later, we all know what happens. So the Torah says, Sinai is going to continue. It's not going to be this moment of revelation. We all took selfies, hashtag I was there, and everything moves on. No. Sinai was much more important than that. It was a consistent relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu day in, day out, when the weather's bad, when the weather's good. It's going to be that we have this connection. That ended on Shiva Asava Tammuz, which means to say, our destination, what Rav Moshe Shapiro argues is our destination, consistency ended on Shiva Asava Tammuz. A consistent connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu ceased to exist. What about our regression? What was the point of, what was the negativity, we'll call it, where we are coming from, which was switched around? When we think about that Tselem in Ahechel, when that image was put in the temple, sometimes we have the mistake of thinking that this is actually a temple-centric sin. This is a temple-centric destruction. No, he says. He argues that no. In fact, the image in the temple is exactly the misrepresentation of what Sinai was. Why was it that immediately when they come down from Har Sinai, Moshe Rabbeinu gives the ten luchos, the first mitzvah right afterwards is, lo sa'asu niti, don't make any images that you saw in heaven, because don't misinterpret what you saw. Sinai was a hearing experience, not a seeing experience. Very important to look at those verbs when you get to Parshas Vayeschanan. Is Sinai about seeing or about hearing? If you see it, you make mistakes. If you make mistakes, you make images. And therefore, this was, in a certain sense, a corruption of the origin, of the point of where we're coming from. There is the luchos, which are broken. There is the point of origin, which you're coming from, which is Sinai being corrupted. The point of destination, which was consistency, which is falling apart. And then you have the right and the left on either side. The right was, if you think about the burning of the Torah scroll, the sum total expression of those luchos was as it's written in the Torah as we have it. When that was destroyed, that was, in a certain sense, our proactive, our mitzvahs, the Torah, the expression of what we do on a day-to-day basis, which is being destroyed. And finally, the left is our protection, the walls of the city being breached. Once again, most people think the tragedy of the breaching of the walls of Jerusalem was the starting of the destruction. But if that's the case, then why don't we just incorporate that as part of Tisha B'Av, right? Tisha B'Av is one long period of destruction. His argument is that it wasn't so much about the city starting to be destroyed, it was about the fact that we no longer had sovereignty and control of our city. The cultures of the world, which were held at bay by the walls of Jerusalem, what we represented, what unadulterated Judaism looked like within the walls of Jerusalem, had suddenly fallen. The walls of protection of not only the city, but our culture had fallen apart. Now again, it requires a little more time to develop each of these ideas. But what his argument is in this particular essay, in this particular ma'amar, is that what was happening over here in Sheva Sabbatim was the sum total destruction of Torah. Torah in what it meant in its primordial state in the Luchos, where it was coming from, where it was going to, what it was supposed to be, and what it was supposed to protect from, were being destroyed. And that's what Sheva Sabbatim is talking about. Let's take this to the next level. What about Tisha B'Av itself? Can we map it up and map it out in the same way? Now, I just want to give a proviso over here. This is harder to understand, so I'm not going to try to map it to the 5 points. There is a way of doing it. I prefer to, rather than pushing that into, he does not identify which of these 5 points it is, but there are 5 dimensions within Tisha B'Av as well, without identifying which ones are which, because I believe that it's harder to understand. Let's start at the very beginning. When you think about what the destruction of Tisha B'Av was, if all of Shiva Asabatamos can be distilled into the destruction of Torah, its expression of where it's coming from and going to, what can all of Tisha B'Av be distilled into? If you were to sort of put that into the distiller and a drop would come out, what would that drop say? What was Tisha B'Av about, all those 5 incidents?
Relationship,
avoda, it's more than that. It's even more essential than that. If Shiva Sabbatamos was our relationship with Torah, our relationship with? So it's more than that. What the way it is to be understood is, and of course there's many ways you can look at this, and all of these are valid points, but in a certain sense it's more basic than that, and that is our relationship with place. Our relationship with place. Let's think about that for a second, what that means, and how all those 5 incidents tie into place and our relationship to that place. Let's try to digest that for a second. Let's go chronologically. Okay, so let's move to the first step. What was the first incident which occurred, which is actually in the Torah itself, not in Tanakh?
Meraglim.
The spies. Let's understand that incident for a moment. When we talk about the nation of Israel, our formation, when we talk about who we are and how we became, part of that is that we are the nation, we were formed as we left Egypt, right? And leaving Egypt is really very much part of our identity. We talk about it in so many of the mitzvahs. We talk about that this is Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. Our formation as a nation, our creation, was essentially at Sinai, at Yetzias Mitzrayim, leading to Sinai, of course, and the receiving of the Torah. What was supposed to be was that we were also supposed to, in the same way as we identify ourselves as people who left Egypt, and that made us the nation, we were all supposed to be within the same sentence, people left Egypt and entered the land of Israel. It was supposed to be one smooth movement. We became Hashem's nation as we left Egypt and went to Israel. That was what it was supposed to be. But we had a little bit of a hesitation in the middle of that sentence. We didn't disagree with leaving Mitzrayim, although a number of us apparently did and stayed there. But for the colonel that managed to get out, we didn't argue about leaving Egypt. We complained a little bit afterwards when there was no food and water. But we didn't argue about leaving Egypt. But we did argue about going into the land of Israel. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in a certain sense, then it had to bifurcate. And the people who were the Yotzei Mitzrayim, who left Egypt, were not the people who were Boyei Aretz. With the exception of a very small group of individuals, nobody who left Egypt was actually walking into the land of Israel. It was a completely different door. Which means our identity changed. Except for the women, of course. And that's why this is at the Amen group, naturally. And also, of course, ages below 20, over 60, Kalev, Yehoshua, the Ya'ir ben Menashe was in the land of Israel, it seems, or at least on the conquering the territories on the east bank of the Jordan, as we heard in the end of Parshas Matos, we just learned. So there are numerous individuals, but if you think about it, in identity, the people who left Egypt were not the people, essentially. There was the people who weren't interested in getting involved in Israel were now barred from access to the land, which means to say our identity is not as inextricably linked to Israel as it is to our formation of the nation as leaving Egypt. That means to say that we can exist without it, and hence the last 2,000 years. Which means to say, because that moment, you know, you hear these midrashim, if Moshe Rabbeinu had taken them in right away, Mashiach would have come, that would be in the end of everything. It isn't this romantic vision. What it means to say is that our identity would have been melded with Israel to such a degree that we would be inextricably connected to it. We could not exist without the land of Israel being part of our bloodstream. But we decided to hesitate. When Hashem saw that we hesitated, he said, you know what? Now Israel is going to be something you have to earn, and there's going to be times you're not going to deserve it, and you're not going to be in it. That was the reality we chose when we were in Meraglim. In a certain sense, what happens? We broke our relationship, not with identity, but our relationship with place. The chosen people were no longer so excited about the chosen land. There are lots of lands and there are lots of people. We're the chosen people and that's the chosen land. And we became hesitant about that. And that repeated itself numerous times when the second base of Middash was being built. People said, you know what? We're all right here in Babel. Everything's all right. The economy's going up. We have our properties. We're still paying off mortgages. There's lots of things going on and they didn't come to the land of Israel. They felt they were existing independently. This was the tragedy of the first initial space where we created a wedge between ourselves, our identity, and the place that we should exist. But it goes a little further than that. When the base of interest was actually built, this is referring to idea number two. Idea number two, what happened on Tisha B'Av was the destruction of the first base of Mikdash. What did that first base of Mikdash mean? It's not just that, you know, we had the base of interest, we could bring Korbanos, we saw the Shechina there. What that means to say is, when the Shechina was there, what was the epicenter of the Beis HaMikdash? It was the Kodesh Kodashim. What was in the Kodesh Kodashim? It was the Aron, with the Luchos and the broken Luchos. But where did the Aron rest? What exactly was it resting on? It rested on a rock. That rock we called Evan Shasia. That Evan Shasia, by the way, I mean, like, we trademarked that long before the Muslims put that dome of the rock there. Right? So we had that rock covered long, long ago. Now, that Evan Shasia, the Gemara tells us, means to say that from it, the world was nursed. From that rock, the world was nursed. Now, think about what that means. What that essentially means is that place, all place, was nursed out of that place. All existence, all context of existence came out of that, which is why, because that's the wormhole, if you think about it, between this dimension and the next in terms of place, that's why there's certain irregularities as occur with wormholes. When you're between two dimensions. And that an irregularity is the fact that you had an entity in it, which was called the Aron, and although the Aron had very specific dimensions, you had to measure 2.5, 1.5, right? You had to know those dimensions, and if it was failing by just a bit, it would not actually count as the Aron. But, and we know that the Kodesh Kodashim had certain dimensions, but if you're to take a tape measure, and you're to measure from one side to the Aron, and then you're to measure from the other side to the other wall, and you're to add the Aron's width, it would be bigger than the room. Which means to say that the Aron was not toifes makom. The Aron did not take up place. Why? Because this was where place emanated from. This was the sum total of space. This is actually the point of origin here. This is our potential point of space. And that was what was destroyed in the first base of Mikdash. When the base of Mikdash was destroyed, the Shechina left. We no longer had access to that space and place in the same way. That was what was going on in the destruction of the first place of Mikdash. There's obviously much more to over here, just to, on a more Kabbalistic level. What he points out is that if you think about this, the name of Hashem, his main name, Yud-Kei, Vov-Kei, Yud and a Hey, and then a Vov and another Hey. If you just square each of those letters, so Yud, 100, 10 times 10, Hey, 5 times 5, 25, Vov, which is 6 times 6, and another Hey, you get up to the letter, number 186. And Hashem's name squared is one, individually each letter, is 186, which is the same gematria as Makom, which means to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a certain sense is giving space to existence. That's what's called Tzimtzum, the space of context of reality. And that is expressed in this place where the Shekhinah was residing. That was taken away from us. That was the destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash. So you say, well, what's left after that? I mean, like, what else could we do after that? So they built the second Beis Hamikdash. And the second Beis Hamikdash, they didn't have Shekhinah. We didn't have that same place. We didn't have that same access to that spirituality. The physicality was somewhat disassociated with that spirituality. So what were they doing? What exactly were they doing when they built this Beis Hamikdash? It was not aligned to the Beis Hamikdash Shalmala as is described. So what were they doing? What were they trying to achieve? For much longer topic and for a different time, but Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky has a beautiful essay in the beginning of Parshas Bo, in the middle of Parshas Bo, where he describes that they knew that they were not remaking the ultimate Beis Hamikdash when they built the Bayis Shem. In fact, there's a mission in Yuma which says that there was a Kohen who was walking around the Beis Hamikdash in the second Beis Hamikdash, and he saw that there was a crack between the tiles on the floor, and he said, wait a second, that might lead to a trapdoor which leads to, you know, and he died. So they realized that they should not be investigating that. And because this mission was so famous, they made a movie about it called The Raiders of the Lost Ark. And this the idea is that it wasn't that they didn't know where the Aron was. They knew this was not the correct time to take it out because right now the Shekhinah wasn't here. So what were they doing? What were they doing when they built in the second base of Mikdash? The argument is, this is what Yaakov Kamenetsky argues, what many people argue, is that this was a way station. They knew they were in Golos. And they knew that even when they came back to the land of Israel, because there wasn't an upsurge of people who came back, this would not be it. We weren't going to make it. We weren't going to have what was going to be Bayis Shlishi. And therefore, when they built the Beis Hamikdash, they did not use the plans of Yechezkel, who told them about building this Beis Hamikdash. They used the plans of Bayis Rishon, even though they knew the plans for the ultimate Beis Hamikdash in the future. They made a much more humble structure under Persian control with Persian building licenses. And that they did was in order to reestablish the Torah Shebaal Peh, to establish a Torah system which would carry them through the Golos which we're in now. They realized that with prophecy alone, once prophecy ceased, they couldn't exist in exile. What do they need? They need to develop a system of halacha. Anshei Knesset HaGdola got up then, and what do? They instituted a few important things. One is formal tefillah, not organic tefillah, formal tefillah. They instituted brachos. That whenever we eat, whenever we experience, whenever we see, whenever we engage in a mitzvah, we say a bracha. They created the system of Jewish lifestyle as we have it. They used the Second Temple era to create the structure of Jewish life necessary to go into that Golos again. They didn't know when it would be. They hoped it would be very long. But that was ultimately, we'll call it Makom Take 2. Makom Take 1 was our relationship with the land. That was the Meraglim. Makom, in its essence, was what the Beis Hamikdash was when we were looking at the source of place, which was the Kodesh Kodashim. Take 2 was what it was supposed to be. Well, what we are trying to make up is at least giving us the place where we had some total control. Finally, and we just let's conclude the last 2 points. Time is against us. But the last two are the destruction of Beitar and the plowing of the Harabais as a field. The destruction of Beitar. There were a lot of people lost. In fact, the Gemara describes that when the Beitar siege was broken, there was so much slaughter that the blood ran to the sea. Now that's a lot of, Beitar is inland. So whether that means hyperbolically, whether that means literally, we're obviously talking about a mass of destruction. But in truth be told, in Jewish history we've had many, many massacres, not to underplay any one of them, but there have been many, many terrible, terrible massacres in Jewish history. And that wasn't the reason why Beitar was chosen as the reason for that we commemorate Tisha B'Av. The reason was, because from the year 135 Common Era until 1948.
Wow.
There has never been Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. You understand, when the Bar Kokhba rebellion took off, when Shimon Bar Kokhba started his rebellion, he was successful. He was able to take control and sovereignty over Jerusalem for 2.5 years. In fact, we have today, if you go to the Temple Sifting Project, you can actually see the coins minted in Jerusalem by Bar Kokhba at that time. He was the person who Rabbi Akiva believed was Mashiach, as Rambam tells us, and that wasn't a mistake. It wasn't because Rabbi Akiva had misguided judgment. It was because Rabbi Akiva understood that he really had the potential to be Mashiach, and it was lost. That means to say that that was the last hope we had, not of place on a spiritual level, not on place as a representative of a Torah society, but as place, as sovereignty as Jews. That was also what we lost. And think about that. Until then, if you think about it, for those 1900 years, we had to abide by somebody else's rules when we went to Jerusalem. We were paying taxes to somebody else, and somebody else told us where we could or where we couldn't go until 1948 and essentially 1967, when through miracles we were able to see the reunification of Yerushalayim. That is a remarkable point. That is another dimension of place. Not place as identity, not place as the spiritual space, not place as a construction of Jewish society and a place to be able to create the structures of what we do today, but place as a place of sovereignty. And finally, the last point, and that is the plowing of Harabayas. Now you think, look, if the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, does it really make a difference if they plowed or they didn't plow it? Like meaning, you know, like whether it's put in, may completely destroyed or partially destroyed, what does it really make a difference? You know, archaeologically, but is that so much more? Does that really exacerbate the issue so much more? Is that so important? By the way, when did this actually happen? This was also in the Bar Kokhba rebellion. As a result of the Bar Kokhba rebellion, there's a little bit of a historical twist over here. You see, Hadrian wanted to make Jerusalem, he wanted to make a temple to Jupiter, the Roman god, in Jerusalem. And that was part of what led to the Bar Kokhba rebellion. After the Bar Kokhba rebellion, he razed Jerusalem to the ground. And Jews were not allowed access for numbers of decades after that into Jerusalem at all. He renamed it Elina Capitolana. Elina, of course, is his middle name. These Roman emperors, very egotistical folks. So he named it after himself, Elina Capitolana. That's when he called it Palestina, which was after the Philistine, our perennial enemy in Tanakh. That's why he chose that name as the state of the province, not because there was a Palestinian people yet. And so this is at this point in time, that was when the Beis HaMikdash was, the area was plowed. So what's the point of the plowing? You know, like, why is that so important? Let's close with this point. The Gemara tells us that each of the Avos had a different relationship with Yerushalayim, with the Har Habayis. The Gemara says that Avraham Avinu called it a Har. Where did Avraham Avinu encounter the Har Habayis? Akedah. He called it a Har. Yitzhak was called it a Sadeh, a field. Where do we see that? And finally, Yaakov called it a bias, a house. In other words, there's a movement over here from a mountain to a field to a house. These are three dimensions of what the Beis HaMikdash meant. Well, what's happening over here is that Yaakov, when he called it a house, it wasn't because there was a house on the mountain. It wasn't because there was a silhouette of that roof. What it meant to say is that to him, there was a dimension of this Beis HaMikdash which was more sophisticated than simply a space. It was something which had become constructed, whether it be spiritually, metaphysically. There was something here, even when there wasn't a Beis HaMikdash. What was happening when Hadrian plowed the Beis HaMikdash wasn't that he destroyed the structure on it. He was undermining the very essence of what Yaakov Avinu had really called it, which is bias. He was reversing it to a place called Sadeh, a field. And think about this. You know that famous Gemara, Rabbi Akiva and his friends, they're walking and they see Harabayis, they see the fox walking out of the Kodesh HaKodashim, and they start crying, and Rabbi Akiva starts laughing. What's the whole point about that fox? Meaning like, you know, so they say yes, because a Kohen Gadol would enter, and if he was inappropriate, he would die. And the fox is now... It's more than that. Where does the fox live? The fox lives in the field. The fox lives outside. What Hadrian had done was he had converted this place, which Yaakov Avinu had cultivated, his relationship with the Avos had cultivated to being a mokum of Har Habayis, independent of the bias. And Hadrian had now desolated even that very point of it itself. So in a certain sense, if you think about this, these are five points of destruction of what place means to us, whether it be in our identity, whether we can exist without it as the Meraglim, whether it be when we go there, and that's the aperture between this world and the next in terms of space, as the first Beis HaMikdash, where it's the place from which all ordinances and structures of life left, as in the times of the second Beis HaMikdash, whether it be the last bastion of sovereignty that Jews were able to exercise their kingship, or whether it be at this point in time, when you think about even the dimension of being a bias or being a sodeh, open or fortified, which may relate to our small over there, to the left side over here. Again, when thinking about this in a more sophisticated fashion, this is obviously the beginning of the conversation, but thinking about that, hey, think about those 5 points. the point of potential, where we are coming from, where we're going to, and how we deal with our proactivity and our defense all the way along. That is what is destroyed, and that is what we're trying to rebuild. B'mehera B'yomenu. Thank you.